Hi there, Three Song Story listener. In order to keep this podcast free to download, we have to remove the full versions of the songs. But if you go to threesongstories.org or put the WGCU app on your phone, you can listen to the full versions of the recordings just like we did it in studio with the guests.
One, two, three.
Welcome to Three Song Stories, the podcast that creates biographical castles using songs and the musical memory blocks they bring out of our guests. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. My guest today is Thomas Allen Harris. He's a many media artist who explores family and identity in what he calls a participatory model of filmmaking that he's been pioneering for nearly three decades now. He's an accomplished filmmaker and public television producer. His documentary, Through a Lens Darkly, premiered on Independent Lens on PBS a few years ago and was nominated for a National Emmy. Thomas was born in the Bronx and raised in New York City and Tanzania. He's a graduate of Harvard College and the Whitney Museum of American Arts Independent Study Program. He's made a number of other feature and short films in his life, and he lectures and teaches widely on media arts and other topics, including an upcoming course around Family Pictures USA as a senior lecturer at Yale University. And oh, by the way, he's the host and creator of Family Pictures USA that I just mentioned. It's a new public TV show that's exploring lives through the lens of the family photo album. It's actually why he's in town. He's here with a team meeting folks and scouting locations to film here in Southwest Florida later this year. So we thought we'd get him into the Three Song Stories chair while he's here. And here we are. So here we go. Hey there, Thomas.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
I'm glad to meet you as well and glad to be here, Mike.
Thank you for taking the time to do this. I know you guys have been on a crazy schedule train. Can you gauge for us how much crazier this schedule train is than your normal train? Because it sounds like you do a lot of stuff. So how busy is this week versus your normal weeks?
Well, we're always in production, you know, and being a transmedia artist, you're kind of always doing, you have three balls in the air at the very minimum. And so this is it. And then I usually crash in the weekend when I can.
So this isn't necessarily like a heightened version of your schedule.
Well, what's heightened it is the heat down here.
Yeah. Well, welcome to, it'll be nicer when you're here in the fall. What got you started down the road of visual storyteller?
Well, I think the earliest point that I can kind of talk about is the fact that I was raised by my grandparents, and my grandmother was – while my parents were in school, my grandmother took care of me, and then my grandfather came home from his job. He would photograph me, and and then later on he would tell me stories because I always asked him stories, and he would love to tell stories. And so he'd tell me stories about his ancestors, and he was also a photographer. And so a lot of the photographs in the house were his photographs. And then I realized as I've been doing my films and finding more and more images that he took over of me throughout my childhood, I find more kind of moments that I had forgotten. And so he was really documenting my life visually in addition to downloading the stories of his ancestors.
Was he a professional photographer?
He did not work he did not get paid for his photography, but he documented his family.
Gotcha.
And it was not just his nuclear family. It was his extended family. So my grandmother's side of the family, he documented at every event. This was his hobby, his avocation. And he also was a member of Bethel AME Church, African Methodist Episcopal Church, for like six decades. And he photographed many of the events of the church, both on color slides, black and white images, as well as video and Super 8 and 16 millimeter.
Sounds like you're not far from the tree, as they say. When did you get your first camera, and what kind was it?
He gave me my first camera. You know, I cannot remember the make of
that
camera.
Was it a 35 millimeter?
It was a 35 millimeter camera, and I actually was shooting black and white. Many of the cousins that I had were also interested in photography, and so they were photographers as well.
And you continued on then as steadily being a photographer straight through to this day from then?
No, I – you know, my brother has. He's a well-known photographer and artist, Lyle Ashton Harris. But I took some detours. During my college days, early college days, I had stopped taking photography and I became a science jock. In fact, I went
I was going to bring up the fact that you were a biology major at Harvard. I was like, okay, that fits perfectly.
I was on my way to medical school. I went to Bronx High School of Science.
Okay, you know, okay.
I had lived in East Africa for a while. When I was about 11, my mom moved with me and my brother to East Africa, and I went to national schools there. So when I came back, I wasn't as comfortable with English, and what translated really easily was the science and the math. And my mom was a chemist. And so I grew up in the lab partially. Whenever I went to her with her to work, you know, it was a chemistry lab, you know, and she was a teacher. And so I was very comfortable with that, you know, the Bunsen burners and, you know, just the smell of chemicals, because she always, you know, when she come back home, she would, after you spend 8 hours in the lab, you come back home,
yeah,
you smell
imbued
of chemicals.
Yeah, with it.
Yeah, so I felt very comfortable with chemistry, biology, you know, physics as well. And so I did that in high school, and I thought, well, maybe what I should do is become a doctor. And it was sometime during my years in college that I realized I don't like blood or flesh.
All the key ingredients to that life, right?
Exactly.
So then how did you wind up back into the world of visual storytelling? Because if I do the math right, you got started in that around that same time.
Yes, yes. I decided to take a couple of photography courses. I had gone in my junior year to Europe for 3 weeks to visit a friend. And I just, you know, I met all these different people who said, you know, follow your dream, follow your passion. You know, I was in Paris, actually.
Right.
So that's a perfect,
perfect place to start a passion play.
Exactly.
Right?
And so I came back and I said, I'm not going to go for like a master thesis, you know, or a thesis rather. I will take some electives in photography and creative writing. And so I did that, and it opened up a door for me, and I, in fact, wrote a grant, my first grant that was successful, and my first grant period, to go back to Europe, and got a grant, became a Henry S. Shaw traveling fellow, and I went back to France and also to Holland and also to Italy, and was working as a photographer and a stylist in fashion as well, and just kind of basically trying to figure out how not to come back and apply to medical school, because I'd taken my MCATs and I'd done well.
So you were on the cusp.
Yeah, I was on the cusp.
Gotcha. What kind of camera were you carrying when you were on that trip?
Nikons.
Yeah. Still shooting film at that point?
Yes, I was shooting film.
Gotcha. Do you still shoot film at all today?
I want to start shooting film. I shoot some moving film,
okay.
You know, but I haven't shot film still using my still camera in a number of years. I can't remember when last. It might be like a decade and a half, 2 decades. But it's something I do want to start doing as well. I recently printed the photograph that I had taken in 1980, I guess it was 87, on the front steps of the Riverside Church. It was as Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou and Amiri Baraka were leaving James Baldwin's funeral.
And you took this picture?
And I took the picture, and it sold recently at an auction.
Wow.
and it was, you know, so I was, I thought, you know, so I started me opening my archives from that period and seeing, you know, all the being greeted by, you know, these memories and these images. And so I'm more interested in moving forward as a photographer in addition to, you know, professionally, in addition to all the other hats I wear.
So what was the musical background of your childhood growing up with your grandparents? What was being played around you? What were you being exposed to? What can you remember if you dig back as far as you can?
Well, you know, Mahalia Jackson was someone that was played in my grandmother's house, and that was a house I would come to after school. You know, it felt a little bit old and stodgy, and you know, very like deeply religious, and it's a music that comforts me today. It was on my list, but it actually didn't end up making the list.
You gotta be pretty hard on yourself with the culling of the list. I know.
Yes. it's like what's on and what's off, right? The list. And so that was something my grandmother, they played religious music. There was no dancing in my grandparents' house. It wasn't forbidden, but there wasn't music to dance there, and unless the TV was on.
Did you ever play music? Did you ever be in a band?
I tried to play the clarinet, which is something my grandfather
tried
played.
In past tense?
Yeah. Okay. I tried for about a year, maybe less. I actually used my grandfather's clarinet.
And so nothing in the modern times.
I'm tone deaf. You want to hear me sing?
Sure.
No, you don't. That was a rhetorical question.
Can you remember the first time that music moved you, whether it be sort of emotionally or, you know, physiologically, that you had something about music that made you go,
Yeah, all that great music, Motown, all the music of the late 60s and the 70s was just, I mean, it was thrilling. You know, it talked about social movements. It talked about love. It talked about caring, all kinds of different loves. It talked about friendship. It talked about betrayal. It was like the music, the drama, you know, and a lot of that music was also in some of those blaxploitation films mm-hmm. around the time, mm-hmm. you know, including the one that, you know, the first film that sparked that movement, Sweet Sweetbacks, Badass Song by Melvin Van Peebles, and then, you know, Shaft. And, you know, those soundtracks were like amazing. In fact, they were the things that made the movies.
Right.
In addition to the fashion.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, as somebody who makes, you know, movies, and there's, like you just said, the sound kind of makes the movie, or the music makes the movie. How much do you think that changes the way you think about music and its effect on things? Like when you're putting together your documentaries, you have to think about the music.
Yeah.
Does that branch out into how you perceive music and where it fits into popular culture and where it fits into people's histories?
Yeah, I do a lot of research around music, and also I collaborate with principally the musician I do collaborate with for the last 25 – have collaborated with for the last 25 years has been Vernon Reid, who is the founder of Black Rock Coalition, and he's, you know, the guitarist in Living Color. And he actually has scored my last four feature films, feature documentary, kind of mythopoetic films, as well as some of the short ones. And so we actually have a really intense intellectual conversation about sound, music, image. He's also a photographer, and we're talking to him about doing some of the scoring for – the principal scoring for Family Pictures USA.
That's exciting. I'm 1 degree separated from him now. Okay, well, let's move on to your first song. And what is it? Why did you choose it? And do you want to tell a story before or after we hear it?
The first song is Lean on Me mm-hmm. by the amazing singer, a musician, Bill Withers. And I could talk about it afterwards.
Okay, perfect. We're going to hear it now. This is Lean on Me by Bill Withers from his 1972 album Still Bill. This is Three Song Stories.
Lean on me when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on, for it won't be long till I'm gone.
Where and when and perhaps to whom does that song bring you back to?
Well, you saw me crying throughout the song.
Yeah, well, you know, welcome to music's power of connection to our pasts.
Yeah, it's 1972 and I forgot the date, and, you know, and it just made me realize, you know, I think my parents had the year before they had officially separated, moving towards divorce. On the one hand, on the other hand, we were part of an extended family. We lived just 2.5 blocks away from my 3 blocks from my grandparents and his brother, my Uncle Philip, and his kids were also kind of like, even though they were second cousins, they were like siblings. Mm-hmm. And my oldest cousin, Ricky, died the year before, 1971. And he was really just, he was a photographer. He took iconic photographs of both me and my brother that we still use in our work. In fact, I used that one of his photographs in my film, Through a Lens Darkly. And the song, you know, for me, it, you know, I guess just, you know, just, I mean, it felt like, you know, I didn't have a great relationship with my father. I didn't really feel like I could count on him. But, you know, I did have an amazing relationship with, you know, Ricky, and also with my grandfather. You know, my grandfather is in some ways like my dad, and he was my mother's father. But with my older cousin Ricky, I mean, he was really he was a magical person, very special. He was, you know, also the head of the camp that I would go to, Minisink, and it was a tragedy. You know, him getting killed in a car accident on his way back from working at the camp with a friend of his. They both were killed, both young men in their early 20s. And it was the first time I encountered grief. And, you know, I did feel like if there was someone I could count on, it was him, you know. And as an older brother, because I was the oldest sibling in the house, my house. And a desire to, like, you know, just to have, you know, to have, like, that fraternity, that brotherhood, that the connection, and so that's what came to mind. And it was also about a certain type of vulnerability as a man to say, you know, I'm there for you, you know, if you need a friend. And, you know, it's something that's really sorely, I feel like, missing today, you know, that kind of spirit of generosity. And you know, speaking of spirit, you know, my mother stopped going to church after she and my dad got married. But, you know, my grandparents would take me to church. But, you know, the music that she played in her house were, well, a lot of the music was, you know, even though it was more cultural and popular music, it had its roots in the African-American church, you know. And so there was those messages that can't come out, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that message that, you know, that if you need a friend, you can call on me, you can count on me, and, you know, I'll be there, you know, and I'm pledging that to you. It's like something, it almost feels like ancient, like, yeah, you know, a bond, yeah, you know. Yesterday we had someone who was Woody Hanson, who was talking about the bond between his grandfather and this Native American medicine man, and how strong the word, the bond of the word, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that for me was just so touching, you know, and that's deeply spiritual.
You know, that song has percolated far and wide through our culture, so I'm sure it comes across your ears occasionally. Does it affect you like it affected you during this, or is it because we're here very mindfully listening to it that it connected you that deeply?
Yeah, it's a combination. I think it's very mindful listening to it now, but also the year and understanding when it hit, mm-hmm, you know, and why I was so attracted to it. Then I would sing the words, you know, yeah, at one point. And also recently there was a film about 4 or 5 years ago by a friend of mine, Damani Baker, a filmmaker who made a film about Bill Withers.
Oh.
And so I was a champion of that film, and I think it might be on Netflix. I believe it's on Netflix.
What's it called?
I think it's called Bill Withers,
okay,
something or another. Yeah.
I'll watch it tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, and by the way, you know who's on the list to do this show?
Who?
Woody Hanson.
Oh, great.
I'm working on it.
Tell me, let me know what the link is. I'll definitely
I will. So as a filmmaker, I'm going to get into this world now. Can you reflect on the way that the festival circuit has changed in the last decade or so? because of technology and putting good equipment in the hands of more people, and digital distribution makes it easier to submit films from all over the world. And I know this because I help the Fort Myers Film Festival run on the technical end of things.
Oh.
And I've seen this arc over the last 10 years.
Uh-huh.
Now, for somebody who's so much further into this industry, can you reflect on what's gone on in the last decade?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's been, you know, the best of times and the worst of times. There's like so much stuff, you know, it's almost like a glut of stuff. But at the same time, there's access to people who, you know, stories and perspectives that we normally wouldn't get.
We've shown several short films from people in Iran that had to sneak it to us.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know? See, that's just amazing to have that, create an audience, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, through the film festivals, I've created audiences in Toronto where I have premiered my three of my films, in Rio de Janeiro where I've premiered at least two, if not three, of my films, in Berlin, same thing, also Japan, Australia, Cape Town. I mean, it's the film festivals are these amazing cultural hubs, and relationships are forged and formed and forged there, and they continue. And so my only regret is I didn't go to every single film festival I was ever accepted to, because I just know that I missed the opportunities. But you know, it was for good reasons, or whether or not they were good. But
right.
Yeah, I couldn't go.
Can you remember the first time that you were interviewed because of your work, because of something you had created that got the attention of somebody who wanted to interview you for a publication?
Yeah, I think it was back in the late 80s. I was interviewed for a film I did, Crisis, Who Will Do Science. It was a film I did for public television. I was interviewed by the Black Filmmaker Foundation Journal, and they interviewed me about my early work. But there was also another article that came even before that. When I first came back from Europe, I made a film that was funded by the Phillips Brooks Volunteer House at Harvard about 10 young Harvard students who move into a low-income housing project in Boston and run a youth enrichment program. And I lived with them and made a film about them.
Wow.
And so I was interviewed for that project as well.
Can you remember the first time that you found out that a work of yours was going to be distributed further than, you know, a screening somewhere, you know, into distribution on a network like PBS or Sundance Channel? I guess that came later probably.
Yeah. Well,
what that felt like when you suddenly realized it wasn't going to just be the people you could hand it to, but the people who could connect to it using other means.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. Besides that first film I made, you know, about the Harvard students in the housing project, right after that, I was hired by a television. I got some jobs in television. So I started making immediately, working in television production, and eventually as associate producer and then as a producer. So a lot of that early work was more traditional work that was broadcast by WNET, by WNYC. And then after about 3 or 4 years, 5, 6 years maybe, I can't remember, like it's from 80, maybe 88 to 91, 88. 89, 90, 91. So about 4 years, 4+ years. I then left and went to the Whitney Independent Study Program and started making, even before I did that, I started making more experimental films and films that might be a little bit more nuanced and focused on identity, you know, both racial and sexual orientation identity and multinational identities. So I started breaking up with the form a little bit.
How much success did you have to have as a filmmaker before you finally went, thank goodness I didn't go to medical school?
Well, I went to see my dentist 2 weeks ago. I told him I was pre-med. And he said, you almost went to medical school. And then he tells everyone in the office, he almost went to medical school. Like, I was like, hey, can you believe this
guy? So you're
guy?
Still waiting for that moment is what you're saying.
you know, I don't know. I mean, it's like, you know, I have a lot of friends who did go to medical school, and, you know, I'm happy for them. Being an independent has its ups and downs, you know, as any creative field, and challenges, I should say, not so much as ups and downs, but I'm so grateful for the life I've chosen.
Back to the musical train in the memories. What was the first music you owned yourself?
Maybe James Brown or...
Have been a record?
It was a 45.
45?
Yeah, either James Brown and or Jackson 5, something along those lines.
Did you ever make mixtapes?
No.
No, that never crossed your path?
No, I mean, I grew up in the Bronx, so I should have. Like, you know, I was part of the hip hop generation, the original, you know, but I wasn't. I'm not sure why. You know, I had just come back.
It seems like it might be kind of your, you know, up your alley in a way.
Yeah, I made Start, actually. Thanks for the tip. I've been thinking about it because I think it's something I do. I mean, I do make mixtapes for my films because I do use, like, I have a composer I work with, but a lot of times Vernon will give me kind of the song plus the stems, and so I will work with Jason Moran. I've composed stuff, you know, with them willingly or not.
Right.
And then I also sample music. I do a lot of sampling, and then my voice is in a lot of my films, and then other voices. So I'll sample and I create interesting kind of soundscapes in this way.
But you never put together a list of songs in such a way that you wanted somebody else to know how cool you were or how musically diverse you were or whatever.
No, but I think, you know, I have a fantasy of doing some, kind of being a musician. I think, somehow, some way, maybe through Apple Music or iMusic.
What is your favorite concert experience?
I would have to say it's either Joan Armatrading.
Oh, she's come up on this show in the past.
Tracy Chapman.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, one of those two.
I'd love to see Tracy Chapman, man.
Oh, yeah. I think I saw Joan when I was living in Europe.
Wow.
Yeah, it might have even been Italy or maybe it was France. I can't remember, but those two were pretty awesome.
Do you see a lot of music, and have you ever traveled for music? And if so, what was the furthest you ever traveled?
I haven't really traveled for music. I, of course, I'll get off the show and come up with a bunch of different examples having traveled for music. But nothing comes to mind right now. I do so much traveling for film and art. That's principally, my travel schedule.
Right. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to song number two.
Okay, so some of the elements that I used to describe Bill Withers' "Lean on Me" are probably applicable to Aretha Franklin. The song is "Say a Little Prayer for Me," realizing how much a certain type of Christian music or ideas, even though they were coming through popular music, infiltrated into our house. And when I was growing up, and these two songs were very popular before I was 11, before I left the country.
The moment I wake up.
Forever, forever, never, 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 never
So about how old would you have been when you're remembering back to listening to this with your family?
Well, it came out when I was 6 years old, but you know, that album was playing a long time in our house.
Right. Well, can you remember remembering it as a love song or you just know, as kind of, because, you know, it's a very love song.
Yeah, I was just writing that down and I was thinking, wow, this is a song that my mother must have, like, you know, loved a lot, you know? And I don't know necessarily, I mean, it certainly informed ideas around romantic love, you know? But also connecting it to kind of spiritual connection. And maybe as a kid, you know, I didn't necessarily identify it as a romantic song, you know, but I probably it was just about kind of like a sense of love and spirituality, which was something that was, you know, really intense on my mother's side, particularly, and of the family, and having grown up in a church, and, you know, and also, really, you know, my grandparents and my mom had an open door to the house. So we had, you know, in my grandfather's photographic archives, there's so many people I don't even know their names of. And, you know, we had lots of cousins who were not tied to us biologically. And so I think that there was this, you know, sense of, abundance of love, and that was wealth in our family. And so I think I resonated with that in terms of the song.
Is Aretha Franklin something that's in your playlist today? And let's try to figure out, what is your playlist today and how do you manage it? Do you listen to Spotify? Do you have MP3s on your phone? Where are you at with that?
I do it all. I mean, I have, you know, a bunch of music on my phone. I listen to Pandora. My brother's been trying to get me on Spotify, and I haven't gotten on Spotify yet. But it's mostly through, I buy music. Where else do I listen to music? I will, get music from the library.
Is Aretha Franklin on your phone right now?
Well, Aretha Franklin's actually in the first pilot episode of Family Pictures USA.
Oh, really?
Because someone actually talks about her, and there was a woman whose family album included her dad.
Oh.
Because Marsha Music, whose father was Jovan Battle, had a prominent record store in the 40s and 50s in Detroit. And that's where Aretha Franklin's father, Reverend Franklin, would go and record all of his sermons.
Oh, wow.
Which are incredibly musical and so moving. I mean, he was from the South, immigrated north, and so this has this, you know, this fullness and this mythic epicness. And he also, Jovan Battle, also recorded Aretha Franklin's first songs. And so that came to us in Detroit.
That's one of the things, little serendipitous things you just stumbled across, right?
Exactly. But that's what happens with our project, Family Pictures USA. I mean, their connections are always made. Last night, there was other connections when we did our event here at WGCU. And so she is very much a part. I love Aretha Franklin. Nina Simone was someone who was also played in our house quite frequently. Marian Makeba. You know, in addition to Bill Withers. I think I had that song, Lean on Me, as a 45.
You've mentioned a couple of the artists that may have been close to the top three. Can you flesh out maybe one or two more that were on your short list?
Yeah, let's see. I thought I had it. On my short list, you know, I keep so many names in my memory, so I have to be really – I have to keep papers with me. So, Mahalia Jackson, because, you know, I started listening to her again. My cousin Ricky actually loved the song Come On Baby, Light My Fire. Is that by The Doors?
Yeah, The Doors. Uh-huh.
And so that was on my short list. ABC is easy, is 1, 2, 3, you know, Jackson 5. Hugh Masekela. I can't remember which song I had, but he was someone that we listened to. And there's a Calypso song by Harry Belafonte that a record of which we had. And so, but I wanted to listen to those again. But initially, I thought this was focusing on, you know, the songs from my childhood.
Right.
And so that's where I was
spending all your mental time.
Yes.
It was what was the process like? You're somebody who thinks a lot about family and connectivity and history and the way things can bring you back to history.
Uh-huh.
What was this project like for you, picking the songs and thinking about your life?
Well, I recall the poetry of the words is where, you know, where it went, you know, certain inflection points, like, you know, dancing to the Jackson 5,
mm-hmm.
you know, with my cousin Peggy or my other cousins, and music that we would sit down with our little, you know, 45 recorder play, you know, independent of our parents, you know, their stereo, which I'm not sure how much access we had, you know, and to their records. Although Stevie Wonder's Songs of the Key from the Key of Life, Songs
mm-hmm.
of the Key
yeah,
of Life
yeah, yeah.
was very something we listened to over and over and over and over again the whole summer. So it was very enjoyable. Yeah. It's very enjoyable.
When was the last time you bought music that had a physical form?
Probably for one of my films.
But for your own personal record use, for your own personal music use?
I can't remember.
It's been a long time, in other words.
Yeah.
So you...
There was one record I did buy, but it was that's also a long time ago. I mean, it's a long time ago. A couple of records I have come with books I bought. I can't remember. Yeah.
Your bio says that you lecture widely on personal archiving and the use of media as a tool for social change.
Mm-hmm.
Can you reflect on how the fact that everybody has a recording device in their pocket is affecting social change in this world?
Yeah. I mean, I think that people using their phones as kind of activist citizen journalism, you know, to record things that normally would be pushed under the carpet. I think citizen journalism is really significant, you know, in all its different forms. I think the things that usually get the most attention are, you know, crisis, high drama stuff. It would be great to get other kinds of stories, and that's kind of what we're doing with Family Pictures, you know, because I think that right now, the family album, you know, as we had known it, no longer exists. And now
right.
it's actually in our devices, you know, our kind of visual record of the both of our contemporary, you know, journeys through our lives, but also images that float into our consciousness, you know, from the past.
Yeah, we're bringing so much more visual information on a daily basis.
Exactly.
Can you think about, you know, I am a photographer and I shot on film before I didn't.
Uh-huh.
And I don't look back on my pictures in the same way that I used to because there's so many more of them or there's something about them, they're more diluted.
Uh-huh.
Can you reflect on that too as a photographer of, you know, just how our connections to our photos have changed because of the ease of taking them and the number that we may take versus before. You know, you go before, you got to roll a film in there.
Yeah.
You'll take maybe a picture of a moment,
mm-hmm.
and either you got it or you didn't. And now you can just go and then go back and go, well, that's the one that got the moment best.
Yeah.
Is that diluting something or is that expanding something or both?
Yeah, but I when I take photographs on my phone, I mean, some of them have been published mm-hmm. recently, but I don't necessarily think of them as something that will be exhibited or that will really last for a long time. You know, I'm recently started going through, as I mentioned earlier, my archives from the 80s, and which were black and white, you know, contact sheets and printing out the contact sheets. And, you know, I mean, those images are strong, just, you know, magnifying the contact sheets. And so there was a deliberateness to the taking of the image, the framing, you know, the sense of economy in terms of, you know, each roll of film has 35 images. I cannot waste these images. I'm very much aware that I need to be judicious.
And there was the cost associated with making them into something you could see.
Just getting the role.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, you could be crazy and buy 100 roles, but, you know, you'd be crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that if you were going to use them wisely, that's fine. I mean, I look at some of those contact sheets and I see like half the contact sheets are really great photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so you know, there is a way in which you feel like the images that we take using our phones have a sense of disposableness about them, you know, a sense of immediacy, which is also tied to branding and marketing, but don't necessarily have a deeper meaning, you know, associated with them, you know, a kind of, a sanctity around them, you know, and so, that really talk about a time and a place. And so I would agree that it is diluting the significance of photographic representation, but at the same time we are leaving, the cameras and the photo technology as we knew it, and not necessarily ensuring that it'll stay, you know, because we're not printing out images.
Mm-hmm.
The chances of that images that we took, 100 years ago will outlast the images we've taken over the last 5-10 years, particularly the last 5 years, it's pretty high, I mean, my cell phone has died a couple of times. I've had hard drives die.
You got to manage
six
your
months.
Data, though,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it's like, but you could be really on top of it, and still, I mean, the great images I took the day before might have been in part of those images that have not been, did not get uploaded. I mean, I pay for things to be uploaded to the cloud now,
right.
But who knows how long that really is going to last. That's a leap of faith.
What about, not to go too far down this road as a photographer, but the in-the-momentness that, like I've shot weddings, right,
uh-huh.
for friends.
Uh-huh.
And then we get done and I'm like, I have no connection to that wedding because I was taking pictures of that wedding. I was one step removed. I was being a documentor. I was not
uh-huh.
being an experiencer.
Uh-huh.
And if everyone's walking around at Disney World with their phones out constantly taking pictures, are they losing the experiencer and being a documenter?
Well, I would disagree, or have a different take. I think that when you're taking pictures, you become a performer.
Mm-hmm.
You're giving a certain significance to the event in the sense that you are the one through whom the transmission of information
mm-hmm.
flows.
Yes.
Because everyone has that experience.
Well,
but
which
you
may
capture
benefit
it for,
them
for
more than you, though. You might be taking one for the team, though.
yeah. That's true. I mean, is this a wedding for hire or is this a wedding of a close friend?
This was weddings for close friends. This is why
yeah,
was
well,
different.
That's service.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
Lean on me.
Okay, thank you for doing that. You just helped me a lot psychologically. Okay, I know you are on a limited time frame here, so let's move on to your third song. What is your third song? Why did you choose it? And is the story pre or post?
I have to set up. In 1974, I moved to East Africa with my mom and my younger brother, Lyle. And my mom got a job teaching in the Ministry of Education in Tanzania. It's in East Africa, just south of Kenya east of Uganda. And we lived there for 2 years. And I went to a national school, which was a state school. I was the only American in the school. Every morning, the students, we were uniforms. The uniforms were white shirts and khaki shorts and usually black shoes, I believe, and white socks. And we would line up for assembly every morning, and we would sing this song.
What's it called?
It's called Mungu Ibariki Africa, and it's the national anthem of Tanzania. And the translation from Kiswahili to English is God Bless Africa. It's also the national anthem for South Africa. And my stepdad, who raised me from the time I was 9 years old, was a South African freedom fighter.
All right, let's hear it. Take it away, DP.
Africa.
When was the last time you listened to that?
I included a segment of that song in my 2001 film, Em Minha Cara, That's My Face, that I shot in Brazil, and I had a segment on Tanzania. And so I listened to it probably in the late 90s or early 2000.
You were singing along, so it's there, it's that deep in you.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I first started school in Tanzania, I didn't know what the words were.
Right.
And I didn't speak Swahili.
Right. You remember it phonetically and, yeah.
Yeah. And so all the classes were taught in English, with the exception of Swahili, which is a national language, and many of the students came from non-Swahili-speaking households, so they were speaking other kinds of languages, Bantu languages, and then also political education, which was – it was a socialist country. And so that was also taught in Swahili. And so those two classes, I was exempted from being an American. And when I first started going to school there, I was just trying to make my way and just try to fit in, and I didn't fit in at all. And so I learned the language to the song ultimately, it was during my adolescence, and it was a newly independent country. It had only been independent for 11 or 12 years, and there were all these other African countries that were becoming independent and to the south of Tanzania, and they were their influence was being felt, and that was very interesting. And the Tanzanians were such friendly people. You know, they were so welcoming, and had been a former British colony, and so I was going to an Anglican church, and then the Chinese came and became the trading partners, and the British left, and so all of the chocolates and the soaps disappeared, and you had this cheap Chinese stuff in the stores.
What an interesting glimpse into a slice of the world.
And so it was a real interesting time, and we would go on vacation to Nairobi, Kenya, which is much more of a Western place, and you could find a lot of the things you couldn't find in Tanzania and Nairobi, Kenya. And so so this song, I listened to, we'd go to school 6 days a week, I believe, if my memory serves us right. Saturday was half.
Seems like that's not something you'd forget.
And I think school would start like at 7 and end at 2 or 1 or something like that, because it was also very, very hot. Mm-hmm. It was very hot, like this, but all year round.
Right, right.
And even hotter, go to 112.
Wow.
So it was, and I had to get to school by myself.
How old were you at the time?
Well, it was 11 going on 12.
Okay.
And so I would catch the bus, and it was kind of a sink or swim situation, because I was the youngest kid in the class, and it was just kind of like, you just thrown in the situation. And, when my mom arrived there to teach in the Ministry of Education, they thought she was a man because they couldn't imagine a woman would come with two sons. And so we were in a cab for like 4 or 5 hours waiting for them to reassign her from like the university where it was mostly male students.
Oh, they had to reassign her because they had her gender wrong.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. And so it was really, and then a lot of things changed. We didn't have housing. We lived at a hotel for 3 months. So it was a big, in the expat community there,
How long were you there?
I was there 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah, formative year, so.
What was it like coming back?
Traumatic.
Traumatic.
Yeah.
Because back was trauma? Well, or just because you had then, those were formative years, you had sort of built up this new person self perspective, and then suddenly you had nowhere to apply it?
Yeah, I had become a businessman in Tanzania. I was like, selling. I was making like these breads, banana breads and cakes, and selling them to people. I'd worked in the chicken farm, and I was selling chickens.
And suddenly that was not relevant in the Bronx.
I had a garden, fed their family. So I had so much independence. It was like, Yeah, just meeting all these new and different people and so exciting. It was very cosmopolitan, even though it was a relatively small capital. And there was also a lot of like intimacy with people. Like, everyone would say hello to one another on the street. Everyone, if you had like a men who were friends and women who were friends would walk down the street holding hands, And it was just like, and then you come back and it's like all of a sudden you're like, no, you have to be much more contained.
Yeah, especially you came back to New York, right?
Yeah.
In the 70s,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was a different New York than it is today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a song that you will always turn off if it comes on the radio, either because of the memory that it brings up or the style of the song?
A lot of songs from college. I don't even remember the titles, but it was a sad time.
Sad time musically or sad time personally?
Both.
Yeah.
things started getting better when I stopped being pre-med.
Okay. And another question that we've asked periodically on this show would be, how would your 14-year or 15-year-old self think about how you turned out?
I think I have my previous selves pretty close to me. So, I recently found a photograph that my grandfather had taken. It was before I was 14 or 15. It was actually 11. And I was, I was at a church podium, giving a sermon at junior church. And, my grandparents always pushed me to do this. I became the chaplain and did all the prayers from, the time I was in 11th grade to 12th grade, in New York. And so I just recently realized how much I my grandparents had really kind of anchored me in the church. And so, to be doing the kind of work I'm doing now, which is very much service work and, about connecting people across our differences and, and trying to be compassionate and non-judgmental and making work that helps people, that's something that is so ingrained in me. And in fact, I recently saw a film and interviewed my colleague, a filmmaker, who made Won't You Be My Neighbor? Morgan Neville, and it's in theaters right now, right here in Southwest Florida, and it talked about Fred Rogers, and he was had studied ministry, and so he was in some ways a kind of TV personality, but he was also rooted in a certain type of ministry, and I think that while I'm very different. I haven't studied the ministry, but it's in me in such a strong way, just like that song, Mungu Ibariki, is in me.
All right. I've got one more question for you. If you could collaborate with any photographer or filmmaker or producer, alive or dead, who would it be?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's hard to answer that question because my work is collaborative. So I love collaborating with people. And so I'm always collaborating with people and helping young filmmakers find their voice. I'm teaching a course at Yale called Family Narratives, Cultural Histories, and, you know, helping people to connect their family photographic archives to movements, whether it's the women's movement or the labor movement or the LGBT movement or, you know, with the independence movements. For me, I feel like I'm doing that all the time.
In other words, everyone who wants to make the world a better place is who you want to collaborate with.
But I can continue to collaborate with.
Great. All right. Well, Thomas Alan Harris, any final thoughts?
Really grateful to be here and have this reflection. And I needed a good cry, so thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Okay.
This week's parting tune comes from Joe in Portland, Oregon.
My song is If I Had $1 Million by Bare Naked Ladies. I was working in Boston in the early 90s, and I had some friends who went to MIT, and one of them ran the radio station there, and he was from Canada. And he encouraged me to come to a couple of shows that were happening in Boston from Canadian bands. One show was the band Moxie Fruvis. They were great, they were talented, they could read and write music, play a bunch of instruments, political, smart, witty. And the show was great, and we got to hang out with them afterwards, and coincidence of that, we became friends and got to hang out with them on a number of occasions when they came down to Massachusetts. Around the same time, my brother Mike emailed me and said he had discovered a new band called Moxie Fruvis, and I wrote back to him and said, yeah, I just saw them the other night, they're awesome. So that always has introduced a little bit of an interesting dynamic between Mike and I over this band, because he fell in love with them perhaps even more than I did, and yet I was hanging out with them in bars and in houses in Massachusetts for a few years. The other band I saw at the same time was a new band, or new to me, Bare Naked Ladies. Really great show, and got to hang out with them too afterwards. And so we became friends with these two bands. And soon thereafter, or around that time, Bare Naked Ladies came out with an album called Gordon, and on the song, If I Had $1 Million, Moxie Fruvis sang backup to the Bare Naked Ladies, bringing together these two great bands that I've listened to ever since. I always wanted to get all of them together and tried to do so many years later, but it didn't work out. Whenever I hear the song, If I Had $1 Million, not only do I think of that time in Massachusetts in the early 90s and my brother and my circle of friends, but it also makes me realize that musicians are normal people too. And every band I go to see ever since, I take that same perspective and, in fact, try to get to know people and hang out with them afterwards and that kind of thing. So it really influenced the way that I think about music and bands and performing in general. And that's my story. $1 million. Well, I'd buy your love.
Have you got a story and a song that goes with it? If so, send it to us at mysongstory@wgcu.org. We'll get in touch with you to record it for a future episode of this podcast. We make Three Song Stories in the studios of WGCU Public Radio on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is producer, director, and co-creator. Tara Callaghan is our online content producer. Chris Duffus is our executive producer. Our production intern is DP Workman, who also directed this episode. Our theme music was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. I'm Mike Canary. Keep listening.
Next time on Three Song Stories. this is back when he was doing his show on like Rock of Love or whatever, Bret Michaels, and actually had a dream.
I'll trust you on that.
Okay, this is like, yeah, I'm secretly admitting it. Two or three years ago, I dreamt I was in a therapy session with him and I was trying to connect. So I took, you know, he always wears a bandana. Mm-hmm. So I actually took a bandana around my head to do therapy with him.